Well, I want to thank you for that kind introduction. I'm very pleased to be able to share some of the research that I've been doing about the history of West Point during the Civil War, and particularly the class of 1862. And I am writing a book about that particular class, and what I found out was that the period of time right at the beginning of the war was a story all by itself. So the talk that I'm going to go through this evening is sort of an expansion of the article that I wrote for North South Magazine on the same topic and whatnot. I have a personal interest in here. My great-great-grandfather was a sergeant in the engineer company at West Point at that time. And I was told by Mr. Black here earlier, his grandfather was served in the Civil War. And this morning, I gave this talk to a luncheon with the West Point class of 53 at noontime. And I was told also that one of her grandfathers had been in there. So my great-great-grandfather was in this particular thing. Well, prior to the Civil War, and this is antebellum West Point, it was held in high regard by the members of the country, the citizens. Its graduates had done very well during the Mexican-American War. Fathers eagerly sought appointments for their sons, and their sons were taught by world-class professors at West Point, whose textbooks and whatnot were being used by other colleges and universities. West Point was the premier engineering institution in the country prior to the Civil War. Well, when the political and social unrest that swept the country 150 years ago reached West Point, it got there about the summer of 1860. During 10 chaotic months, and you can measure it sort of between Lincoln's election and a month or two after the firing on Fort Sumter, the cadets at the military academy saw their leadership, the commandant and the superintendent, change three times. They saw more than half of the officers, their instructors, resign or return to their regiments. They had, of course, 11 states that seceded during that period of time, and half this class resigned. During the first few months after the firing at Fort Sumter, the president and members of his cabinet castigated the military academy for the loss of cadets, and members of Congress tried to abolish it within the year. So West Point had clearly lost the respect of the country at the beginning of the Civil War. So what I'd like to do is take you through. I've got some historical pictures to show of this particular period at West Point, and then I want to talk about the events that sort of shaped West Point history right at the outset of the war, and then take your questions at that point. Let me see if this works. You have to get oriented. This is a 1867 map of West Point. And the blue star is up there, just to sort of orient you for some of the pictures. That's the intersection of two carriage roads that's there. I was going to pull a bullseye up there, but I thought Sarah Palin might get a little bit excited. This picture here was taken from the hill mass upon which the cadet chapel is now resides. This is, of course, the barracks. It's about half of what I remember as central area. It's an L-shaped building at this point. This is the academy. That's where they took their classes. The old chapel sits right here, and then post headquarters over here. Post headquarters is where the commandant or the superintendent had his offices, the quartermaster, the treasurer, the post adjutant. This is where new candidates came in order to arrive at West Point, and I'll talk about that. And what I want to do is to use the class of 1862 is sort of an example of what other cadets in other classes were probably going through at the time. How many graduates do we have here tonight? Not too many. You guys keep me, so don't tell too many lies about this place. So, as we go through, and of course West Point sits 55 miles north of New York City. It's right on the bend in the Hudson River where they put the chain across during the revolutionary times to stop the British fleet from going up. If you were a candidate and you arrived at West Point, you either came up the river by steamer or down the river from Albany, or you took a rail line, which it was only on the east bank of the Hudson River, up from New York City, and you got off at Garrison's Landing, a little place just across there. You took a ferry across to South Dock over here. At South Dock, this road is cut into the grouts, because you got to go up about 160 feet to get to the level of the academy. And this is the riding academy. It sits on the corner here. The largest steel structure, stone structure in the country at this particular point in time. Now, you're on the Blue Star. If you turn west, this is the academy. This is the cadet barracks. That's quarters three down there. That's where some of the instructor officers, officer instructors lived. And then if you turn north, that's where the superintendent's house is, the commandant, and it's called Professor's Row. That's on the western side of about a 42-acre grassy area called the Plain that's there. On the north end of that plain, that's where the West Point Hotel stands, about just a little bit beyond where Battle Monument stands today. That's the site for the official visitors. That's where the families would come to visit their sons that were up here, and tourists. They come from New York City, get away from the city and during the heat of the summer, and sometimes to escape some of the epidemics that were there. If you go back to the Blue Star and it turns south, that's this carriage road. Goes down to a place called South Gate, not too much beyond right where those trees are down there. Now, if South Gate is still about a mile and a half further south from that particular area, this particular road right here is still there, and some of the old houses are still there. This is the mess hall, just beyond right there. Just beyond that is where the hospital stood. The cadets ate at three long tables that were in there in this time. They marched there three times a day. Food wasn't that great. It was mostly hash, sort of roasted meat, boiled, whatever they had it. Not a lot of vegetables, potatoes. They would get rice and molasses bread pudding for dessert, coffee and tea. They had to pay extra for holiday pies and cakes, some of the ingredients that they had to them. Take it out of your cadet account that would go through there. The cadet barracks, the L-shaped piece, there's actually about 190 rooms in here. There were bachelor officers that lived in the barracks. In the 7th and 8th Division over in the corner, just around the corner here, is they had those. And the TAC officers had their offices in there, so the four companies were arranged. No running water in this period of time in there. That was a plebes deal. They had to go out to a pump, which is right in front of the guardhouse here, fill it up, take it back for the upperclassmen, and then come back and pick it up and use it for themselves. The heating system was terrible. During the wintertime, they had furnaces in the basement down here, and the heat came up through flues in the wall. On the northern side, if you've ever been up there during the wintertime, when that wind comes down across the plain from Montreal, you'll know what I mean. But there were letters that talk about the cadets having to study with blankets around their shoulders or with overcoats on. Sometimes even the water buckets were frozen solid. So they the room. This is two sketches that were written by or drawn by George Woodruff from the June class of 1861. Kind of a Spartan outfit that they have. The alcoves with the beds in it, not much different from what we were up there. We probably had more furniture that was in here. These are the flues that are there. The fireplaces were blocked. They had gas jets that they used for light and a little bit of heat, so they couldn't do much. Summertime, the cadets left the barracks, went across to Fort Clinton up on the north side of the plain, and they went into a summer camp to live the life of a field soldier for about 8 to 10 weeks. And the summer camp lasted through about the 29th or 30th of August that took place. They studied, at that particular time, it was mostly practical military engineering, a lot of tactics, and infantry, cavalry, and artillery for the upper class, and usually the school of the soldier or the school of the company for the lower classes as they went through it. There was a lot of free time for the upper class. They had free time in the morning, some in the afternoon. Lots of drills that took place in parades that the tourists would watch as they went there. And this is a sort of a somewhat fanciful description from Harper's Weekly of the hops that would take place. The dances that took place at West Point three times a week, either at the hotel or in the lower floor of the academy in the fencing room. The West Point band would provide the music that would take place in there. They also had dance classes, and the sword master would give them there, and then would charge them 25 cents a head to take dance lessons, so they would be up on the latest quadrilles and polkas and reels. The cadets said during the academic years that it was very disciplined, also kind of monotonous and dull. It was study, go to class, eat, study, go to class, drill, study, and then lights out late. Up early in the morning, if you were a plebe, you were taking math, 3-hour math classes. In the afternoons, it was English. The upper class, the other classes were about an hour and a half apiece for there, but it was 5.5 days a week that they took the classes. Parades and or drills at least once a day, closed study after the meal, an evening meal, and then taps at 10 o'clock. Mandatory chapels at Sunday, as for some of us, we went through that up until, I guess, the mid-1970s, I guess, when they finally changed that. They marched every place, 3 times a day to the mess hall. All classes marched to classes. First class formed up inside the cadet area closest to the academy. The plebes were furthest away. They did it by section as they went through. And, of course, marching to the mess hall that they talk about. In 1858, the guy who was in charge is Brevet Lieutenant Colonel Richard Delafield. He's on his second tour as a superintendent, and he's in charge of about 450 military at the post there. Now, West Point is the oldest continuously occupied post in the United States at this time. It still is. There's been soldiers there since 1775. So he's got control of about 450. The military, not counting the civilians and family. He supervises the academic staff. This is Dr. Church and Bartlett and Mahon and about 9 or 10 other senior professors and about 35 to 40 officers who actually instruct the classes that they have. The Commandant of Cadets is Brevet Lieutenant Colonel William J. Hardee, and he will resign within a year and become General Hardee, Confederate Army, and eventually become a Corps Commander in the Confederate Army. And that's where the tactical officers are set and the people who teach tactics at the Academy. There's a post complement. There's an artillery battery, an engineer company, and a West Point band that were there. And then there's the United States Corps of Cadets. It's an infantry battalion organized with 4 lettered companies. It's arranged by height. A and D Company are the tall guys. B and C Company are the runts, but that's not politically correct. That's the shorter guys are in B and C Company, as it was said in there. There's about 270 to 280 cadets that are there at any one time. It's controlled by how many appointments are available through the representatives, and the president is allowed to have 10 appointments at this time. And it's also arranged around 5 classes because West Point is a 5-year institution. Had been since 1854 and when Robert E. Lee was the superintendent and Jefferson Davis was the Secretary of War. The first 5-year class is about to graduate. That's the June class of 1859. There will be one other class will graduate by then, and that'll be the class of 1860. You might be interested to know that some of the instructors are there, and they're not in this picture because this is an 1870, 72, 73 picture. But some of the instructors that were there actually commanded the cadets later in the battlefield. Gouverneur Warren, Oliver Howard were first lieutenants teaching mathematics. And, of course, they will become corps commanders in the Union Army. E.P. Alexander, Longstreet's chief of artillery, is teaching drawing as a second lieutenant. Fitzhugh Lee is a TAC officer of A Company in 1861. This is the atmosphere that the class of the candidates, which would become the class of 1862, come into in June of 1858. Now, they're allowed to arrive at the military academy anytime within the three-week period. And that's because everything is so geographically far apart across the country, it takes that long sometimes for them to come here. If you wanted to get from California to New York, by clipper ship, it still took you 100 days, and you definitely didn't want to go by wagon train, and there is no transcontinental rail that's going on at this time. They had to be between 16 and 21 years of age, and they would arrive, come up to the post adjutants, and they would turn over all their money to them. They had to have about $65 or $75 to start with, and they were told that they would be paid $30 a month. That was a cadet pay. If they were accepted as a cadet after they're going through it. Sometime during, they were tutored in basic mathematics and English, during the month, and then on the 22nd of June, they took an oral exam in front of the academic board. That's the superintendent, the commandant, and all of the senior professors. They would ask them questions. They'd send them to a blackboard. They ask them to do addition, multiplication, subtraction, division, conversion of fractions into decimals. They were asked to read from a designated paragraph in a book, and they also had their penmanship and their spelling check. Now, as simple as that sounds, only 66 of the 84 that came there in that June passed that exam. But that's not the total number. If you go to the cadet register on the 1st of July, you will find that there are 66 that entered in this time frame. There were actually 9 more that joined the class before the end of the summer. One was what was called a turnback, someone who'd failed the class the year before, and one from Custer's class was dropped back. 9 or 8 others joined the class because you were allowed to replace some of these that had dropped out. The congressman would reappoint someone or get some new candidates that would come in there. They would take a special exam in the end of August, and they could become part of the class. So there was 9 more that joined it. So when I said the class is going to drop halfway, my starting point is 75, and I'll tell you when we start the halfway. At 75, they came from 24 out of the 32 states and the Nebraska Territory. And in that class, there were 25 Southerners. Now, Southerners, during my talk, are only those that come from the 11 states of the Confederacy. So these are 4 members of the class that actually graduated. Just to introduce a couple of them, George Gillespie, the only Southerner that graduated from Kingston, Tennessee. Reinald McKenzie, first in the class. He was one of the presidential appointees. His father was Commodore McKenzie, deceased before he came there, but his uncle was John Slidell, senator from Louisiana who became the Confederate representative to France. Next to him is Morris Shaft. Put Morris up here simply because he wrote a very extensive book about 30 to 40 years after he was a cadet called The Spirit of Old West Point. And a lot of historians use that as a text to talk about this particular period. And then Tully McRae. Tully McRae was a transplanted Southerner, born in Natchez, Mississippi, but orphaned early. And he went to live with his uncle in Ohio and became much more northern and was appointed from Ohio. He was a prolific letter writer. There's 265 of his letters in the archives up at West Point. He's kind of the main character that I'm using in the book because we can go up and read through those letters. But there were some Virginians in the class. James Deering was in the class. Oliver Semmes, the son of Raphael Semmes from the CSA Alabama Raider. And Singleton Van Buren had a nephew that was up here. So it was there. Now, at the beginning, I said that things sort of arrived at West Point during the summer of 1860, and it didn't just arrive and it just started at that time. It was always there. It just sort of grew over time and became much more vocal and much more strident in the views out by both Northern and Southern cadets, because you had a lot of abolitionists that were there at the same time, as well as you had Southern cadets who were very adamant about states' rights. Back in 1846 and in 1851, you got Jeb Stuart. When he was a cadet, he said he didn't know any North or South. He didn't particularly like being on the soil of Yankeedom, is the way he put it. The instructors would excise things out of textbooks that had to do with slavery. They avoided discussion. The superintendent even put the Presbyterian Church in Buttermilk Falls, which is Highland Falls, off limits because of abolitionist teachings that was taking place there. You got external things that are happening, the Dred Scott decision, Lincoln's view that in there. But then there's John Brown's raid. And nothing was the same at West Point after John Brown's raid. Now, I think you all know the story about what happened with them. John Brown and 20 conspirators came in, took some hostages, and came into the town of Harper's Ferry, Virginia, and at that time occupied the arsenal. The impact on West Point was that one of those hostages' son was in D Company, and it's James Washington. was there. So his room became the initial information font for everything that was going on. The other point is, of course, Robert E. Lee commanded the relief force of Marine Company that went there, and Jeb Stuart was along with him. So the next day, on the 18th of October, Jeb Stuart knocks on the door, asks to have the hostages released, and Brown rebuffs him. Lee sends a Marine Company in. They capture Brown. There's several killed, and Brown is turned over to the state of Virginia, and he goes into the court system. So there's about a month trial that takes place. During that period of time, there's some incidents at West Point that take place and in the Northeast. You have some of the northern intellectuals that talk about what John Brown being a martyr, being on, he would, when he dies, he'll be on a cross of gold. The newspapers are not saying anything about it. The Southerners are aghast at this because they think he's a murderer. You know, he could be a terrorist in the time frame that we're doing now. So anyway, those things are taking place there. There's a fight at West Point between Emory Upton from New York, who is an abolitionist, also went to Oberlin College in Ohio before he came to West Point. Oberlin College allowed women to be educated and freed slaves. Two hot-button issues with Southerners. Wade Hampton Gibbs, in the mess hall one evening, makes some comment about Henry Upton's relationship with the Negro women. Upton calls him out, and there's a big fight that takes place in the 1st Division one night. Morris Shaft is there, and he's got several pages he talks about this particular fight, but he never says who wins. So you can't tell on this thing. There's some other things that happen. Pierce M.P. Young, later a brigade commander for Hampton down in South Carolina in the latter stages of the war, comes off guard mount, and he takes his sword and he swings it around over his head, and he says, "By God, I wish I had all the Yankees lined up between West Point and Newburgh, and I'd cut off the heads of every damn one of them." Well, Morris Shaft sort of sarcastically said, you know, if you allow 2 feet to every Yankee and you line them up between here and Newburgh, you probably have 100,000 of them that are set there. And he says that would probably make the Northeast quite incapable of meeting their draft commitments during the war after that. So nothing was the same at West Point after John Brown's raid. A year later, this is the summer of 1860. Presidential campaign is underway. You know the thing there, Lincoln for the Republicans, the Democrats are split in half. Impact on West Point. Breckinridge has a vice presidential running mate by the name of Joseph Lane from Oregon. Joseph Lane's son is in D Company at West Point. So a lot of interest in what takes place now on the presidential campaign. There is a third party, John Bell, that's constitutional. Jefferson Davis is at West Point. He's a senator from Mississippi, and he is in charge of a committee investigating the five-year program that he helped install. His military assistant is Major Robert Anderson. John Floyd from Virginia is in a continual battle with the academic board. And the reason is that the academic board has very clear rules about who should be dismissed. If you fail subjects, you're going to get kicked out or you're going to get turned back. If you exceed 200 demerits per year, you're going to get kicked out or you get turned back. And John Floyd says, let them go on with their class. So there was a back and forth that took place here with Floyd. New commandant shows up. John Reynolds takes over from Hardee. He's now a brevet lieutenant colonel that takes place. If you happen to be wandering around in the minstrel shows, you'll hear a new tune, Dixie's Land, a little bit different from the little title, but that's the original title on the thing that took place. The most important thing that took place here for the class of 62 was they got a chance to go on furlough. The only time they were allowed to leave in the five-year period of time for any extended periods was during the summer of their, as they started into their third class year. And the academic board was not very kind to the class there at the military academy. But this is the number I'm going to start with, okay? 54 in the summer of 1860. Okay. These are some of the events which sort of shaped West Point history starting after the summer of 1860. There are some historians, and Morris Shaft also put in his book, that when the furlough class came back, they brought with them sort of an upsurge of regional prejudices, sectionalism that came back. Plus, you had the presidential campaigns that were underway at this particular time. Morris says specifically that the South Carolinians were extremely vocal about states' rights. In the class of 62, there was a red-headed firebrand by the name of Henry S. Farley from South Carolina. He said, if Lincoln is elected, I will resign. The South Carolinians at the academy wrote a letter to the Columbia Guardian, said they wouldn't serve under him as commander-in-chief. Well, you know, Lincoln was elected. Henry Farley became the first cadet at the military academy to resign his commission at the outset of the war. A month later, South Carolina legislatures begin the secession process. And a week after that, Major Robert Anderson, now in charge of the federal installations at in Charleston Harbor, that was me, I'm sorry, takes his little band across the harbor at Charleston and occupies Fort Sumter and brings James Buchanan, the president, leaves him with an incident that he can no longer ignore during the last 2 months of his presidency. At the same time, John Floyd is forced to resign. You have a new Secretary of War, John Holt, that comes in. In March, and I will tell you that in December, all the cadets had to take exams. They also do it in July. These are written partial exams, if we remember beforehand. But you can imagine what would happen if your sons or daughters are taking their SATs and whatnot now, and their states begin to secede, and that's what happened. The cotton states all seceded, and Texas went out on the 1st of February. Winfield Scott said he believed that when the Electoral College met in Washington, that he needed more regular troops there, and he ordered the artillery battery and the engineers to leave. When they left, they took all the horses with them. There's no classes left. There's no cavalry training, no artillery training. It takes place for several months up there until they could be replaced. The superintendent gets changed. One of the things that Buchanan agreed to was to have a well-respected Southerner take over from Delafield and change as a superintendent. And PGT Beauregard from Louisiana comes up. He's operating the engineer office down there, the customs office. He comes up. By some accounts, when he passed through Washington, he made the comment that if Louisiana secedes, I will resign. And John Holt, the Secretary of War, did not want a Southerner to resign as a superintendent of West Point. He orders Delafield to take his job again. Beauregard was in place for about 5 days as a superintendent, and then Delafield took back over again. That's two changeovers that's taken place in the January time frame. Now, this is February. Mark, you do your minute. Let me do February. United States Army is only 17,000 people, maybe 1,100 officers, scattered all over the country in small setups. There are six departments west of the Mississippi. One of them is the Department of Texas, and it's head by General Twiggs, Nathan Twiggs. When Texas seceded, a citizens committee comes in and goes up to General Twiggs and says, we want you to turn over all the equipment and supplies to the Army in your department. This is one quarter of everything that is in the United States Army. And Twiggs said, okay, signs the order and turns it over. He's fired by Winfield Scott and will resign very shortly thereafter, become a general in the Confederate Army for a period of time. Lincoln is inaugurated in March. This is the president was inaugurated in the March rather than January at this particular time. And most of the Cotton State cadets have left. There's 12 in the class of 62 have left. And just at a point in time, there were 278 cadets there in November. 86 of them were Southerners. 19 of them belonged to the class of 62 that were there. Now, the cadets that were there, and there's a mixture of letters and whatnot from various people, were really, the Southerners were placed in sort of a crisis of conscience. They had to make a life-changing decision. They sought advice from their families, from their friends, from the politicians that appointed them. They talked to cadets from the same state. And they were trying to figure out, what do I do? My state has seceded or about to secede. What should I do? The South Carolinians and the Mississippi didn't have any question at all. This is John Kruger Dixon. He just left, you know. And you can't just leave, by the way. You are a commissioned officer in the military. Only the Secretary of War can approve you leaving, and you had to submit a letter of resignation to there. So the superintendent had to pull all this together, put the recommendation, and then send it on down to Washington. So it took a little bit of time before they could leave. The Southerners in the first class that were still there in the March time frame, John Pelham from Alabama, Alabama's already gone out, and Tom Rosser from Texas. You know, there was only about two or three of them that were still left. They wanted to get that diploma. And the reason is a West Point diploma was extremely important. They knew that it was after they got out of the military, had 5 years at West Point, 3 years in the Army, that many of the major construction projects, the bridges and tunnels and rails, were being managed by West Point graduates. They wanted that diploma that would serve them well later on. So here's Pelham talking about this, also pressure from his friends, all wanting him down in Alabama to resign, and he's resisting them. Here's PMD Young talking about the result of the what the great sacrifice of resignation means. DuPont's parents call and write a letter to him saying, hey, these guys are getting commissions in the States, and they're still commissioned as a cadet. How can that be? That created an issue in the class of 62 because two of them were called into the superintendent's office. And the reason is because all the commissions were published in the Herald Tribune. He's standing there from the governor of Georgia, had put the commissions for all the Georgia cadets in there. He made those cadets physically write out a letter saying, I have not accepted a commission in a state's militia while I'm still a cadet, before he would allow him to send the resignation back down to Washington. The big problem was, to whom did they owe allegiance? Was it to the Union? Or was it to the state? This is Tom Rowland from Virginia. And he sort of says, you know, you either have to fight under one flag or under the other, you know, that takes place. Now, this particular oath that they're talking about, the solemn oath, it comes from a cadet warrant. This is Tully McRae's warrant from the archives. And when he's there for 6 months, you sign off this warrant. And in the middle of that is an oath. I do solemnly swear I'll bear allegiance to the United States. And I'll explain a little bit more about this than it has been. But that puts him in as a sort of an officer between a warrant officer and a second lieutenant. And they did this after they passed their exams in January as their plebes. Now, April was probably the most tumultuous month that took place there. Started off kind of calmly. You had a new superintendent. They've appointed Alexander Bowman to come in to take over from Delafield. And he's sitting there. John Reynolds walks in and says, boss, the plebe class never got their cadet warrants. In all of the turmoil that took place in January, with the change of the secession of seats, the units leaving, the exams and all this cuss, nobody sent a message to Washington to send the cadet warrants up. So Bowman says, all right, we'll have the normal formal ceremony, and we will have it in the chapel on the 18th of April. Well, I think it was Von Moltke who said, no plan survives the first shot, if I paraphrased it correctly. And the first shot was fired on the 12th of April, 4:30 in the morning. Now, my belief is Henry S. Farley fired that shot. Henry S. Farley was a platoon leader right there at Fort Johnson, and I believe that he was the guy that fired the first round. Van's going to talk about Fort Sumter in April and be explained this, so I don't want to get too more difficult into that. But anyway, Henry S. Farley shows up. By the way, Henry S. Farley is the brother of Will Farley. Will Farley was Jeb Stuart's chief scout and was killed at Brandy Station and whatnot. Farley came up and became part of Stuart's command after that, took care of all the dismounted cavalrymen all the way through the end of the war there. Of course, Lincoln called for 75,000. The border state refused to go along with it. You got Washington cut off. And on the 17th, Virginia secedes. A couple days later, Lee submits his resignation. Fitzhugh Lee submits his resignation. And a month later, of course, you got North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas that follow as they go through. They did go through with the ceremony. Tully McRae wrote a very descriptive letter about what transpired with this particular class, because no cadet had ever failed to take the oath of allegiance. The Corps of Cadets came into the chapel. The plebe class was brought in. they came up five at a time, put their hands on the Bible, raised their hand, and they swore that oath. This one here. That oath isn't much different from what I remember taking on Battle Monument 100 years later. But 10 in that class failed to raise their hand. This is Edward Anderson from Virginia. That afternoon, plebe class, writing a letter to his mother saying, I refuse to take the oath. I don't know what's going to happen to me. I don't know if they're going to let me resign. But I don't believe a true Southerner could sign that particular oath. Now, tumults continues. The first and second class request permission to graduate early. And the Secretary of War agrees to have them do that. He also says, we're going to dump the five-year program, and I want all officers and all cadets to take the oath of allegiance. And they set that up for the 13th of May, the following month. When that came out, that's when John Pelham and Rosser believed, there's no way I'm going to get to graduation, and they submit their resignations. There are a stampede of cadets, is what McCrae said, that took place in this point in time. There was about 30 to 40 of them that actually turned in their resignations, because now not only the Virginia cadets, but North Carolina and Tennessee and whatnot had cadets turn theirs in. On the 6th of May, the first class, they were going to graduate a month later anyway. They already had their officer uniforms and ready to go. They get passed by the academic board, and they are graduated. This is a class of Ames and Upton and Kirby and Judson Kilpatrick. 45 of them graduate, take their oath as officers. They go off campus. They head for Washington to become part of McDowell's growing army here in Washington. 6 of them resign before they get to their first unit. 45 days later, after a very compressed academic program, Custer's class is graduated on the 24th of June. 34 of them. 3 of them will resign before they get to their first unit. That's set in there. A month later, first Battle of Bull Run. The fledgling army goes west, right out here, and meets Beauregard and Johnson. And Morris Shaft is back at West Point, and he's walking down the carriage road. And he sees a group of excited officers standing around one of the professors. And the professor calls out to him. He said, Mr. Shaft, the Union Army has been defeated and is fleeing to Washington. Shaft goes back to the summer camp that evening. And the way he writes it, he says, his classmates were at the end of the rows of tents singing patriotic songs to keep their spirits up that night. This is now, they're the third, Tully McRae's class is now the first class. They've been advanced 2 years in 45 days, 2 years academically and 2 years as cadets. The Secretary of War now says, we're going to graduate you guys too. They go back into the barracks. They start a very compressed program, and 3 days later he changes his mind. He says, nope, you're going to stay for the whole year. They finally found out that they had too many candidates coming in the following year. They weren't going to have enough cadets to be able to handle it. So they kept the class of 62 there, and it graduated a year later. Third Commandant of Cadets takes over. Reynolds goes back to his regiment, and Christopher Augert now takes over. Now, those are pretty much the internal events up at West Point. What I want to add to this is what transpired down in Washington. Lincoln's administration is now in charge. His Secretary of War is Simon Cameron. He writes his annual report and castigates the military for the loss of officers. He says they lacked discipline. They can't tell the difference between right and wrong. When Lincoln convened Congress, he wrote in the middle of his multi-page paper that he sent to Congress that in the government's time of need, large numbers resigned and proved false to the hand that pampered them. Kind of flowery language by slamming people for deciding to resign. Now, these two guys up here, Benjamin Wade, Zachariah China. I mean, they're part of. They are part of the radical Republicans in Congress. Think Tea Party activists. I mean, these guys, they ended up being the chairman and co-chairman of the Joint Committee on the Conduct of War. Look at the words that they used. The academy was a hotbed in which the rebellion was hatched. It hatched more traitors in history than Judas. I mean, this was Congress mirroring the outrage against the military academy in the country at this time. Congress required two more oaths of allegiance. John, you would really love the ironclad oath. It's about a page and a half long, and the lawyers would really love it.
Yeah.
They even found enough votes to basically vote down the annual budget for West Point. This is as you're going into the January of 1862. Okay, class of 62 did graduate in the 17th of June. There's only 28 of them left. 54 in the summer, 28 now that have been there. The rest of them are resignations. Some of them became Northern lieutenants. They went to Northern regiments, but the preponderance of them were Southerners and went to join the Confederate Army. Officers' kits, about $250 to $300. A ring was $25. A class album was about $50. That's a lot of money in this period of time. Most of them were in debt by the time they started out. Second lieutenant got paid $105 a month. Rations for a servant, forage for a horse, and sort of pay for them. When I graduated 100 years later, I got paid $220, $230 a month. So there's not a lot of difference there in 100 years. But anyway, they graduated on the 17th of June, and most of them went to the Army of the Potomac. Back to Washington. This is late 1862, early 1873. There are some historians that believed that what the radical Republicans really wanted was to use the Army to enforce emancipation in the seceded states. But look at the battlefield performance in the first six tries. You can almost hear those radical Republicans up there saying, "We know why that happened. The commanders are all Democrats." Old Jacksonian arguments are starting. This is the military academy builds an aristocracy, and it's not something. There was a strong belief that the volunteer soldier would come forward. He would learn how to lead armies and bring the country victories. Professor Mahan testifies several times in front of Congress trying to downplay some of the things that were happening. He writes a number of letters to the New York Times, again, talking about what's happened at West Point. In 1863, in January, the members of Congress tried to abolish the military academy. They tried to get enough votes to be able to abolish it. Well, you know that what happened. The Union was preserved as there. Put just up here just to tell you a little bit about what happened in 62. Rinald McKenzie, Major General Cavalry, with Sheridan at Appomattox. George Gillespie was Sheridan's chief engineer. You get the Medal of Honor at Cold Harbor. Morris Shaft, you know the big explosion that took place at City Point in 1864? That's Morris Shaft's depot. He was the ordnance officer in charge at that time. There was a court of inquiry, and they thought originally that it was his guys that had done it. But it wasn't until after the war that they found a Confederate spy had put something called a horological torpedo in there and had blown it up. And the only reason they found it was he tried to get a patent for it and said, "Hey, it worked pretty well at City Point."
Proven in the field.
Yeah. Telly McRae. Most of the campaigns with the Army of the Potomac, he went south in 1864 and served in Florida and was severely wounded, came back to teach math at West Point throughout the end of the war. And this is John Califf. If you see John Trione's paintings that talk about McPherson's Ridge on the first day with Buford, John Califf was his battery commander. He had the six guns that are up there. Those six guns that are at the base of Buford's statue are Caleb's guns. He chased him down 50 years later when the statue was originally put up there on the piece. Yeah. These are some later pictures that I've been able to find. This is Rinald McKenzie later on. He became quite an Indian fighter. 4th Cavalry. This is McKenzie who chased the Apaches across the border in Rio Grande. This is McKenzie's Raiders, the TV show back in the 50s. There's five books written about him. You can even take a Civil War tour training behind Rahal McKenzie's tour. Gillespie became the chief of engineers as a major general before he retired. The Army Medal, the design of the Army's Medal of Honor is called the Gillespie Medal. His committee redesigned it at the end of about the 1890s because there were so many patriotic groups that were issuing medals that looked like the Medal of Honor. He came in and redesigned it to what it looks like today. This is the Army Medal. Morris Schaff became a businessman in Connecticut, was also a brigadier in the Confederate States Forces, and became the oldest grad that was there. This is Tully McRae at 1903 at Gettysburg, up on where he was stationed is at Ziegler's Grove with Woodruff's Battery. And this is John Califf, Colonel John Califf, 2nd Artillery at the end of his career. Well, I can't end this by leaving you with the impression that West Point did not regain the respect of the country, but it didn't escape unscathed that took place. There are some historians, like Stephen Ambrose, who believe that West Point sat on its laurels and actually stagnated. They didn't change their programs at all the way up through World War I. The bicentennial historian, Theodore Crackle, took a little bit different view. He said he believed that West Point concluded that its key principles were validated by the war. The Thayer system worked. If you teach enough math and science, you get mental discipline. If you teach the people to become generalists, then and measure them on the same scale, then you get the standards of performance, and that drops over into the Army. Well, to me, the best metric is what happened at the end. You had graduates that commanded both armies, most of the corps, the majority of the divisions and brigades, and the logistics systems on both sides. So West Point did regain the respect, and it was the actions and exploits of its graduates that did so. And I thank you for your attention. Thank you. Sir.
How did the Southern officers, like Lee and others that had already, left the academy, how did they justify breaking the oath? In other words, what mental gymnastics did they have to go through?
I don't think I can.
How big of a crisis was it?
I'm not sure that they can do it. I don't think any of them, they knew they had to leave the military before they could accept a commission with something else. And I think most of them did.
Right. So
Lee in particular.
Resigned,
right.
Your conscience was clear.
Right. Pelham knew absolutely that he couldn't hold a commission in two armies. He was an honor bound. He felt, and of course the Southerners had a very strong belief in honor. They were very, very much attuned to that. So, but there were, when the cadet oath was an issue, and there was a letter from one of the mothers in there that said that she didn't think it was that you're underage, therefore it's not really a contract and whatnot, but we got you by for 8 years. Sir,
have you read the book Rebel from West Point?
That I have. If it was a very strict civil engineering program that they went through, that was the academic benefit. Almost every topic that you had to have in order to be what we consider to be a professional engineer today, they went through all these things. It was a very, very strict program that they went through. Professor Mahon's department ran most of the engineering side of the house and was very strict. I mean, he locked up the cadets in the class and put a guard outside one day and said, "You're not getting out of there until you come up with the right answer for that homework problem I gave you." So. Sir.
I understand one of the textbooks was called The Laws of Nations, which was taught at West Point in the late 40s, 50s, which one of the chapters said that secession was indeed legal, and that some of the officers, Southern officers, used that as one of their reasons, that this was actually something that they were taught by the academy.
I've only read, I think, one account of something like that, and my understanding is that it was only used as a textbook for like 1 or 2 years. So it was not a widespread textbook that was used for a number of years that a number of people might have been set in there. But I can't attest to that completely on the thing. But, sir?
The last point there.
Wait, go ahead.
Okay, one thing I read about that, I think the book he's referring to is The View of the Constitution by John Rawl and Jefferson Davis. It's what the book said. I've read the chapter that refers to that. What it said was that it was the states that created the nation, the federal government.
Right. Yeah.
And Jefferson Davis was at West Point at the time that was taught. He was taught from that. And when that was the reason he was never brought to trial. His defense lawyers were going to enter that in evidence. And when the prosecution found out they were going to enter that, then they suspended the trial and didn't have it.
Yeah. Sir. Sir.
The last point there, medical performance, look at the results. How do you account for Braxton Bragg, John Pope, and various other two West Point graduates who, shall we say, were not the most successful people around? You never hear about them. You hear about the ones that make it big.
Yeah, it is. I can only tell that those people who ended the war in those particular positions had learned their lessons well. The same thing happened in the Union side, you know, that you had generals from a political side of the house as well as West Pointers that didn't do that well. Sir.
You mentioned Kilpatrick. I understand that he and Farnsworth had words, and that was one of the reasons Kilpatrick sent Farnsworth to his death at Gettysburg.
I've only read one account of that and out of the Gettysburg discussion group about... Judson Kilpatrick was the May class of 1861. And just that. Sir?
How do you account for General Thomas being a Virginian?
Yeah.
And going with the
I can only say George Gillespie was a Tennessean. His family was a Unionist group. And his family was behind enemy lines basically for almost 2 years while he was a cadet. He promised his dad that he would stay with the Union in there. There you'd see a number of places where the cadets, the Southerners, were set up. The story about Thomas, of course, is legendary. That his sister turned his picture to the wall and refused to acknowledge him for the rest of her life. I will tell you that one of the cadets from Georgia, James Alexander, in the class of 62, did not want to leave when Georgia went out. His father wrote him a letter and said, if you don't resign and come home, they're going to confiscate all my stores and property. He came back, but he didn't join the Army. They drafted him in as a private, and the first thing he did was he chose a place, and he went AWOL, got on a ship, came to New York City, and he stayed in New York City for 2 years. So there were differences of how people actually would go in there. Other cadet stories about their... Frank Manny from Tennessee was dismissed in June of 1860. But before the secretary said he's going to be turned back, he decided to go join Garibaldi's army in Italy. He fought with Garibaldi's army for 3 months and then came back to Tennessee and raised Manny's sharpshooter battalion with Bragg's army and the set in there and fought that way. Was captured at... Fort Donelson, escaped from a POW camp, came back to the sharpshooters, and then lasted with them through the end of the war. Sir?
Yeah,
you hear all these stories about the cadets that snuck off post to Benny Haven. Did much of that go on, or
yeah.
was it just good stories?
Yeah, no, it did. They Frank Hamilton put on civilian clothes, went across, rode across the Hudson to Cold Springs, and was able to pick up a bunch of his contraband, brought it back without getting caught. In plebe camp, Morris Schaff went down and got himself, the way he called it, a bottle of pretty poor whiskey and a piece of pie, and changed over his civilian clothes. He traded off with one of the civilians down at North Dock. So, Charlie.
What infantry or military training did they receive at that time?
What military training?
Yeah.
Almost everything from the time that...
Napoleonic?
No, they were steeped a lot in Napoleonic war. They... Mahon ran the strategy side of the house, and he did have really went through all the Napoleonic wars that they had up there. Had big maps put up. In fact, Lincoln came up in 1862, and Mahon gave him a bunch of the maps that was there that he had put up. Sir,
on that same question, it doesn't seem that they got much academic learning into command and control of a large staff.
None. The United States Army didn't have a force that was bigger than a regiment at the time. Most of the army was broken into about 80 or 90 small detachments that were scattered across Indian Territory and out west of the Mississippi, or in the harbors and areas across there. They had a regiment they were assigned to, but divisions didn't exist. And you didn't have a corps or anything close to an army at the time.
First Manassas was the largest clash of arms.
Five divisions that were there, and that was it. Sir,
how did the honor system evolve from those times to the modern
day?
Does it stay much the same?
No, I don't think so. I'll tell you a story. George Armstrong Custer snuck away from the barracks one night, snuck into his professor's home, and opened up his desk to get the answers to one of the exams, and got away because the maid was coming in to clean up, and almost got caught. So, their thought of the honor system against a cadet does not lie, cheat, or steal is completely different from nowadays. And there are differences between the academies, by the way. Naval Academy doesn't have the same piece in there as what the military academy. Yeah.
I think the honor system, as we got to know it, started during MacArthur's regime, right after the First World War, and it stayed pretty much the same until the second cheating scandal. And if you were caught, you were gone. But we lost so many cadets during the two cheating scandals that they modified it to permit...
This was the 1950, the football...
No, I'm talking about the ones I was involved in.
In the 73, yeah, the electrical engineering piece. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sir.
Is Mahon any relation to Alton Thayer Mahon?
I'm sorry, say again?
Is he any relation to Alton Thayer Mahon?
The naval
strategist?
I don't know. I will have to find out. Wait a minute. You got a Navy guy in the back who could probably answer that.
Dennis Hart Mahan's son. Farragut's son went to West Point.
Okay. Sure. Thank you for your attention. The.